The desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul. We each have an inherent wish to create something that did not exist before. The more you trust and rely upon the Spirit, the greater your capacity to create.
I'm Nancy Hansen, and this is Everything Creative. This program explores a wide range of creative ideas, talents, and experiences through interviews and group discussions.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people don't know what a music producer is.
What else goes on this song? Like, what other instruments and stuff?
Cello and violin.
So guitar is kind of the main thing.
You know, and I think even there's different definitions of music producer, even to people who think they know what a music producer is.
Play a little bit more.
This is Scott Wiley, an award-winning musician, producer, and audio engineer. Scott's working with a young band today, recording basic guitar tracks for their upcoming album. I'm Ryan Tilby, and this week on Everything Creative, I'm sitting down with two people who are asked to be creative every day. First, we'll talk with Scott Wiley. Scott's a California native who's becoming widely recognized for his innovative ideas and great-sounding records. And then we'll meet Sam Carden, an Emmy-winning composer with a long resume writing for film, TV, and his own solo jazz career.
My definition of a music producer is somebody who helps you get your music recorded in the way that you want, but also enhances kind of your vision. Like, you know, that's basically is the creative side of producing is that as an engineer, you know, you can say, well, my job is to document your music and you go play and I'll make it sound like that in here, you know, in the other room or on a CD. But a producer gets involved. Again, it's my definition of a producer, but a producer gets involved and says, I love what you're doing there. I'm going to help you bring out the best of that. And maybe, you know, what about this idea? Or have you thought about doing this? Or have you thought about doing that? I spend a lot of my time kind of trying to exploit the little things that people, I don't know, how am I trying to say this? People will be playing and there'll be some little idea that comes out. And then a lot of times they're like, oh, yeah, not that. And they move on to something else. And I spend a lot of time saying, hey, you know that thing you did back there? You should do that more, you know, or that was really great. Do that. And I find the same thing when people produce me as a player. If I'm playing guitar or something, when I'm produced, most of the time, the things they really like are something I probably would have thrown away.
There's a click there, but it's at 120, which is what it defaults to.
Maybe sometimes the best parts of what we do are not what we normally do, so we're not as comfortable with them.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case or not, but sometimes I would always feel like as a player, again, you know, somebody would say, oh, you got to do that. That was awesome. And I'll be like, no, that was junk. I can do better than that. And somebody else was able to see, no, that's not what you normally do, but you are good at that. You should learn how to do that more. Or we should, you know, exploit that.
That sounds great.
I just feel like sometimes if I think something should go one way, if I'm working on a record and I think this should be like this, and they're not kind of going there naturally,
yeah.
Sometimes I can find a way through something they're doing. I mean, I rarely say, this is my idea, this is how we're going to do it. But I can find, like, oh, they kind of hinted at this back there, and I can go, back there, you were doing something really great. And it's psychological. There's a lot of psychology. But it really is trying to say, you did it. You came up with it. But I'm here third party, and I can see, like, that's worth doing more. I failed music production management, actually.
Oh, you did?
I did. Yeah. Well, I took it. It was one of the classes at USC, but I have a degree in music recording. It's a Bachelor of Science degree,
yes,
from USC. And one of the classes in that course was record production management, which I failed because I slept through the final after an all-night session. And so I said to the instructor, who was one of the heads of that department, I said, "Hey, I missed the final and something." He's like, "It's all right." He said, "I know that you know how to do this stuff," because I was doing people's final projects and stuff, you know, and I was doing it. And so he let me pass. I don't think I got an A, though. I think I just got a pass. Yeah, I was fine with that. I mean, I remember in third and fourth grade, like, my thing was, you know, pretending you were in a band. And I was, you know, in elementary school and high school, I was playing trumpet and whatever. But I remember, you know, it was always about, like, being in a band, being a musician. And so I remember I graduated from eighth grade, and that is the year where I grew up, that you move from junior high to high school. And so my parents bought me a four track, like a cassette four track, and I just started recording like crazy, you know, just recording anything I could, recording music and with my four track and making songs and stuff and learning how to do that. And then when I was in high school, I got an eight track and a little mixer, and my dad actually dug a basement under our house so I could have a room for a studio.
He dug it for you?
Like, yeah, like he had, I mean, that's what he did construction. So it wasn't like he just took a shovel one day and started doing, but he did, he dug a basement in under our house and built me a studio where I would record my own stuff, and I had bands that I'd meet around town and I'd invite them in to come record and stuff, and kind of kept doing that through college.
I'm not saying don't fix it. I'm just saying it doesn't bother me.
I haven't worn these shorts in like probably a year, and I just found $3 in the pocket.
If you sell one less copy because of that static, I will pay for it.
I never thought about doing anything else. And I remember when I never thought about it at all. my dad would say, you know, my parents were super supportive, but I remember at one point saying to him, you know, like, my wife's dad was really helping steer them, you know, "You should do this career because this career pays well and you can stay at home, or you should do this career because it suits you this way or that way." And I think it was probably obvious to my parents that this is what I wanted to do. But at the same time, sometimes I think, hey, where were you on the on the direction towards something that pays? That would have been nice.
Yeah, it just gets darker from there.
Yeah. I was in a band the whole time I was at USC that got more and more serious and started, you know, talking to labels and working with producers itself by the end of my school time. But I also worked at studios, normally one or two studios at a time. Yeah. So sometimes it was like school, intern at one place, drive across town, intern at another place, sleep for 3 hours and go back to school, you know. But I was really, it sounds funny because now it sounds like just about the worst thing that could ever happen, but I was all about it. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. I thought this is awesome. And it was free jobs, you know, like this was not money. And then I would also work at I had this studio at school that we could use for free. So I was just like, yeah, we're going to do a lot of albums here. So I was working there too, you know, but, I went through school doing that, like every night and every afternoon was full of either working at a studio or playing in a band. So I was doing this half engineering, because it wasn't teaching producing, it was teaching engineering. It was a lot of physics and a lot of music theory, a lot of microphone design and who knows what, you know, a lot of technicalities. No, so, and I wasn't a member of the church then either. So, which is not to say I was like drinking the whole time. I'm just saying I wasn't a member of the church.
Sure.
So yeah, went through college like that, and then first year of college, I would drive to Provo a lot because I had a friend who'd play. I'd played drums with in high school, and he was LDS, and he came up here to just go to school, and he would say, come up. And so I'd throw all this musical equipment in the car and I'd drive up and we'd play shows. And then I'd drive back down. And I thought it was just the greatest thing because it was a college music scene like I always had wanted but didn't have in LA. So he would, I would come up often. One of the times I was up, we were walking on BYU campus, and he said, "Hey, you want to hear about the church and the missionaries?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds cool." And so we flagged down these missionaries who were walking across BYU campus, and as you can imagine, they were quite surprised by being asked to teach the discussions to somebody right there. So we went in some random room at BYU, and I heard some of the discussions, and then he left on his mission. I heard a couple more, but I was just being a flaky young guy and just kind of stopped calling the missionaries back, you know, not for any particular reason. The first few discussions, especially the first one, like I really felt the spirit and really felt like I liked it. You know, I liked taking the discussions. I liked hearing about it. So I wasn't averse to it. It just didn't stick. So then the last year of school, he came back from his mission when I was a senior. And, he said to me one time, "Hey, you should take the discussions again. You should start taking the discussions again." And I felt really just kind of guilty, like I had flaked out. Because, you know, the missionaries call you and leave a message, and you're like, "I'm not calling that guy back." After a while, you feel guilty about that. So I said, "Yeah, I'll take the discussions." And then I kind of just committed in my own mind, like, "I'm going to take all the discussions, you know. Like, I'll see it through. I won't be flaky again." So I did that. And I drove the missionaries completely bananas because I wouldn't commit. Like they like third discussion, they're like, "So can we set a date to be baptized?" And I'm like, "I haven't even heard everything yet. What, you know, what are you talking about? Like, no way." So that went on. I didn't commit to anything until I had heard all the discussions, which they really didn't like so much. But yeah, then I joined the church after that, graduated school.
Just supposed to be like mood and like a pad basically underneath it, then I think it's rad because it's so dark that the vocal and the cello and violin don't really sit on top. But if the guitar part itself and the intricacies of it are more important, then it's pretty dark.
I like it personally.
I like it a lot.
I was working in some kind of rock studios, which is a place you might find more like drugs or drinking or something. Yeah. But I was also working a lot in film scoring stages, which is not to say I don't know anything about the live. It's just very business professional. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So things are just done. They're just that you don't see that. So I didn't really run into that very much. And then I was in a band with a singer who, for no religious reason, had decided, "I'm not drinking, I'm not doing drugs ever." And I just was not faced with these temptations. Even in school, I started out my first year, I, you know, everybody's like fraternity, sorority. So I pledged a fraternity and went through all of the awful hazing and everything. And then like the last day I was like, "I don't even want to do this." And I quit. So I just like didn't grow. I just never was that guy. So it was not anything I gave up when I got baptized. It was just like, "Well, you can't drink and you can't smoke." It's like, okay, you know, I don't do that anyway. So like there was no big, the biggest thing I said, I would think that I sacrificed just by becoming a member of the church was just, I had a lot of friends who were like, they weren't happy about that. There was a little intervention on my part to try to teach me of my wicked ways.
Come, ye children of the Lord, let us sing with.
At the end of my senior year, that band broke up. Well, actually, I got kicked out before they broke up. But there was all kinds of conflict throughout that whole thing. So here I was, like, graduated from school. I had a girlfriend that I had known in high school who, she was just going to school at BYU, Sarah, who's my wife now. So she was just coming up to school, and I was graduating. I wasn't in this band that had been my life. I didn't really feel like I had anything to do. Yeah. So I thought, I've always loved it in Provo. I have whatever it was, $2,000 saved up or what, it was nothing. I have enough money to go to Provo and live there from October to March. So that's what I'm going to do. And I had this little recording set up, and I had bought a little more gear from money from that band, and I had, you know. And so I moved to Provo. I moved downtown, like right behind this big bar in an old clothing shop. And I moved in there, and I built a shower. And I, you know, like the shower was in the recording room. Like this is where I lived. It was just, I had to redo the bathroom. I had to do everything. And I just rolled in there with my little studio and lived in there too. And I just thought, well, I'll be here till March and then I'll go back and get a real job and start working. And then I just met this band and then they knew these guys. And pretty soon I'm like working, recording bands. And then pretty soon I'm kind of in another band with that same guy I went to high school with. And just stayed.
All right, you ready?
Come to the light spot. Come see the light. And now I'm going to eat a keyboard.
I firmly thought, once March rolls around, I'm out of here, you know? And then I just kind of got more and more stuck, which is not to say that was bad, but I mean, I just got, just stayed, you know? And it wasn't until after we were married, oh gosh, 4 or 5 years, that we were like, why do we both live in Provo? You know? And because she had graduated and I had just stayed and I did this job and both our families were in LA, it was like, we should move back. So we did, but there wasn't really a whole lot of planning going on. It was a lot of just like, well, this is working. Let's keep doing this. I don't know. I should plan more. I think the point of this interview is plan more. I've had that experience myself a lot too, where it's like, where you feel like you're praying for some sort of answer to something, or you're trying to find out and you don't get the, this is absolutely what you should do. But you also feel like, well, why shouldn't I do it? You know, yeah, that's a good point. The only good thing about most of the studios I worked at is they were in this area of Hollywood where the farmer's market was. And like this one studio, the door to the studio was the farmer's market. So for that reason, we didn't work Sundays because it was too hard to get in and out. Yeah. So it was like a real blessing when I think about it, because I was never really asked to work Sundays, because that would have been a hard choice when you're trying to start out to be someone, say, will you work every Sunday? Because there were studios that were working every Sunday all the time. Sure. And I never, at least at the beginning, didn't even have to worry about that. But man, you just felt like, I don't think this is worth it. And then a weird thing about music that might be different, that is different than other businesses, is you have this, maybe it's not, but I have this vision of somebody who's, I don't know, a high up in some company. And the higher you go, the more able you are to take time off or to hand things off. And you just get a little of your life back. And that first, however many years you're, you know, paying your dues, as everybody says, and everything, and that's seems to be the case in many jobs, not all jobs, but in this job that is not the case. Like the people whose jobs I was aspiring to, the producers, had the same crummy hours I did. And so then I was like, wait, why do I want to do this? I thought I'd be golfing. And so then that was a real eye opener, like, oh, the finish line on this doesn't look so great either. Hard family lives and hard to be married, people who hadn't been married or had been married and were divorced, just because how do you keep that up, you know? And it didn't feel worth it to me.
Okay, what do you think? You want to hear that? You want to hear it with click or without?
Without. Let's see if you can...
Oh, yeah, I haven't done a lot of golfing. I do work a lot, but, I mean, you know... Like, I went and picked up my kids from elementary school today and took them to lunch. and then, you know, came to work, and I'll stay late tonight. This is an unusual project, but now I'm in the bishopric, I don't even work evenings all that much. And so it's the great thing about here is when you say, I can't make it that day because I got to go to my kid's game, or whatever it is, people say, okay, what about the next day? And in LA, it was like, oh, really? Well, we're going to find somebody else then. And there's plenty of those people, plenty of other people. And there just wasn't the understanding. And plus, here, things just aren't taken quite as seriously. Not that they should be in LA, but they were. And here, everybody's just like, okay, well, we'll get it done when we get it done, for the most part. You know, I mean, even when there's deadlines, it's not like you lose your job over them. I love working here. And I'm such a dork to move from Hollywood. I'm the record producer who worked in Hollywood and moved to Provo to do my job. It's just ridiculous, but it's worked out.
Play again. Maybe dig in a little bit more.
When I first built a real studio here, and had hot payments and had employees and stuff, I got a calling to be in the scouts, and I went in there and I said to him, I can't take this calling because it's Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, and like I work at, you know, all the time at 4 o'clock. That like, because at the time when you're a cheaper studio, you're typically working around people's schedules, sure, so everybody can work after work, so that's when you work. So. So at the time, it just seemed like I don't think it was true, and I didn't have enough faith at the time either. But I felt like I can't take this calling. Like I need to work. Now I'm in the bishopric, and I have meetings every week, and I have things I have to attend to, and I make my schedule bend around those all the time. I don't worry about it at all. And maybe I'm more confident in what I'm doing, or I feel more comfortable that people, the work will still be there. And maybe it's probably all that, but I certainly just make my schedule work right around those church things now. And I wouldn't even dream of working on Sunday unless it was the absolute worst case ever. You know, I mean, I don't have any problem saying, yeah, I'm not working. And that's probably a lot of just the blessing of living here. But I found that I have enough faith to just say, I can't do a session that night. I gotta go meet with this person or whatever it is I gotta do.
Better get that last chord. For the click.
There was that very first part of the song too.
This job can be really hard, like any job. And I do have to remind myself sometimes, like, look, like I used to work for my dad and I'd be like literally digging ditches, you know? That was my job. Like, go out there and dig this ditch for this wall. And if I think about it, I'm like, yeah, I'm way better off than that. But I just work in a really different way than a lot of people, where I'm not particularly good at being really creative without being inspired by something. So I have a hard time and make a point to turn down things where I feel like I won't get in a position where that's going to happen. Which is not to say I can't just be an engineer. Sometimes I take projects, turn them down as the producer, and say, I'll engineer and help you make it what you want it to be. But it's happened a number of times recently where I've turned down things as the producer. And it's kind of funny to think that maybe they didn't even know what that meant. They were just asking me, you know, maybe they didn't know what it, but to me, I thought, they're asking me to be part of their artistic process on this and to be creative on their behalf. And I don't get this music, or I don't know that their manner of working is going to work with what I do. Yeah. Because I'm really not prepared. Like, I'm not the guy who comes in with, we should do all this and this. Like, my main thing I do at first is just say, I'm going to get all these guys that I think will do a great job on this project and put them in the room. And then I'm going to let them slug it out for a while. And then I'm going to go in and say, that idea was great, and this one was great, and we should put those together and keep going. And I'm, like, harnessing other people's creativity.
Yeah.
I don't come in and say, here's my vision for this song. you know? And so some people don't work well in that because they kind of want to hear something up ahead, like, hey, can you send us a sketch of your ideas for the song? It's like, 2 hours after we start, I'll tell you that. Like, I have no idea, you know? I listen to the song, I get to know it, I make sure that we have a rapport, and then we just see what happens.
Listen, I don't know what I'm doing. I just want to take a nap and have a cheeseburger. Okay, here we go. One, two.
I'm sure there's a sound to them, but it is my secret hope that there's not.
It's the G string.
I mean, there is because it's just like a painter. To me, like musicians that I would call. We're talking in terms of a singer-songwriter who doesn't come in with a band. When they come in to me, it's my job to kind of hire the players. And I choose those players carefully based on how I think they'll react to the music and to each other. And so those are like the colors of paint you use. And so in the end, if you use the same colors of paint a lot, you end up with something that looks, that has similarities. But I'm not trying to make something sound one way or the other. And in fact, sometimes I find myself like saying, let's not do this again. We did this, you know, let's not do that. But I really am trying to get real, like, honest performances. And I think that an honest performance is like a capturing of like that spark of creativity. I mean, if you're a musician and you find an initial creative moment and write a song. My job when you come to the studio is to make sure that it doesn't sound like the thousandth time you've played that song, but it sounds like the first time you played it. Let's say you write a song and you play it the first time, and there's feeling A that comes with it. When we record it, we might get feeling B, because it's the first time you played it in this new way, with this band, or in this tempo, or in this key. But whatever it is feels fresh and exciting, and you are delivering the message you want to deliver behind the song. So that can sometimes be different than when you originally wrote it, but it's still creativity, it's still people being artistic. I mean, you look at my studio and the way it looks, and lots of people, I always know when I'm not really going to get along with somebody if they kind of laugh when they come in. I'm okay if you laugh because it looks ridiculous. I mean, it looks like a circus in here, and I recognize that. But the point of it all is, hey, this is a different place. This isn't your home. It's not your parents' house. And it's not someplace you need to be worried or nervous. It's not too professional. You are supposed to be relaxed here and be able to just do whatever you want to do and be creative. But the truth is, if you can't become a true artist, you can't really be creative, that music that you record won't communicate with people because it won't be honest, and it's the honest music to me that communicates with people. The really manufactured music, like a really great pop song, can technically be so good. You know, I love some Britney Spears songs. Like, there's some amazing. I mean, the production and everything is just phenomenal. But they don't stick with me. They're not songs that I think I'm in the mood to really hear that song, or that song evokes this feeling from me. I appreciate them more on a technical, listen how amazing that sounds or that hook is or whatever. And I think that part of that is because the honesty in the performance is lost in all of the technicalities of editing and perfecting. So the stuff I work on, I want to really communicate right to you where it's like, well, that's a little flat, but it's awesome. You know, yeah. Or that guitar was a little loose, but man, that felt great. And so that's ultimately like what I'm trying to do. I have this vision of somebody painting, and you always think of the great painters as being kind of like almost like mad scientist side to them, where they're sweating and painting frantically. I mean, I know this is how it's portrayed in movies sometimes, but I do have this vision of like this painter, and he's frantic trying to get his painting down, you know, because he has this grand vision. And then I switch gears to, like, the musician who comes in my studio, and they're just trying to get something recorded, and they're not – they don't get artistic at all. Like, they don't get emotional one way or another, happy, sad, whatever it is. They're just in there to just technically get it down. And I think that you've lost the art part of it. You've lost the only part I'm interested in, frankly. You know what I mean? Like, I'm interested in your – what you personally have to say about this. And how it makes you feel, that's what I'll either connect with because I hate it so much, or I love it so much, or I get it, or I'm interested because I don't get it. And when you lose that, then there's nothing really left for me.
It's a little sharp, just pull on the string.
That's good? Yeah?
It's just the one chord.
Yeah.
All right. You ready? It's the next one.
Magic. Magical.
Sam Carden is capable not only in film and TV scoring, but as a solo jazz artist as well. I sat with him in his studio to see how he's able to pull such beautiful pieces of music out of thin air on a regular basis.
What is your job?
Oh, that's a funny question. Well, I'm a composer, and I'm still kind of discovering exactly what that means. But and it doesn't mean now what I used to think it was going to mean. I started out. I grew up in a town in New Mexico called Farmington, and it's an oil and gas boom town. And it's at the convergence of three different cultures. There's a Latino culture there and a Native American culture. The Navajo Reservation is just 30 minutes from my hometown. And then there's a bunch of Okies and Texans that came in for the oil boom. And so you wouldn't describe Farmington as the hub of the cultural universe, but there were a group of really special people who happened to be LDS there, and people that were committed to the finer things, and we're committed to education, and so I felt like I grew up in a very culturally literate environment, but without access to great, teachers. There were some, but I had a really fine piano teacher who had been trained at some Eastern institution with a very good reputation. I don't know if it was Juilliard, but it might have been Eastman. Mm-hmm. And so somehow she ended up in this little town, and I took piano lessons from the time I was 4 until I was 11. And I was one of these little kids that showed some promise, and my mother was very motivated to try and get a concert pianist out of her family. It hasn't exactly panned out, but anyway, she had a stroke when I was 11. And it's sad for her, of course, but it was fantastic for me because I was no longer going to be picked on the baseball field because I had to leave to go to music lessons early. And I can still remember these little kids making fun of little Sammy Carden as he went off to music lessons. I've had a very varied career. How's that? I have had a lot of diversity, and I'm really, really happy about that because I do think I have musical ADD. I don't think I could just pursue a career doing one thing, and so it's been filled with lots of variety. And for a while, I did jingles. You know, that's the bottom feeder. That's, you know, when you're doing jingles, that's, you don't want to tell anybody about it, you know. And I did music at one point I did the Worldwide Wrestling theme. How's that?
Yeah, that wasn't on your...
It's
not on your page for some
reason. Oh, my kids would be crushed if they knew that wasn't on there. I did music for ABC Sports, which was really fun. That was great. And boy, did I love the royalties from that particular era. And I did music for Good Morning America, so I did quite a bit of TV work for a while. And then after that, I toured with the Osmond family and was music director for the Osmond Brothers for about 5 years. Amazing bunch of people, lots and lots of fun, lots of travel and exciting things happening there. Met a lot of really interesting, legendary people. So that was fantastic training. And then I had a jazz career for about 4 or 5 years. I had some chart-topping things happen there. And, you know, this is thanks to people that saw that I had some interest and ability and promoted me. And I'm a very reluctant promoter of myself. And so it really takes somebody else to push that forward. Yeah, I have received some industry awards, and it's been really fun, and it's validating. The very first time that I released a jazz album and it was getting played on the radio, I could not believe it. And, you know, every time anything like that happened, especially with my background, it was just surprising and shocking. It was just a bonus. And I was already having fun, so that was just an added bonus. Well, there's a new book, an interesting one, called Outliers, and it's the same guy who wrote The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell, I think is his name. Anyway, in this book, he talks about how creative people like Mozart, successful entrepreneurs like Bill Gates and Steven Spielberg, and those types of people, you know, we look at their work, and many of them were kind of wunderkinds. You know, they were the types of people that had, it seemed like, meteoric success and at a young age. But he makes the argument that these people, for example, he talks about Bill Gates having given access to a mainframe computer at the University of Washington when he was 13 or 14 years old. And by the time he was 17, he had developed software for the city of Seattle. And then he talks about Mozart having written a symphony at 8 or 9 years old. It wasn't any good yet, and how much of it was his father, really. But his symphonies that were recognized as iconic works didn't happen until much later. So he posits that it takes 20,000 hours dedicated to your chosen field before anything of a world-class nature evolves. And I think that by the time any of that kind of stuff was happening, I had probably logged that amount of time. Yeah. And so I can see that. And especially someone of my limited outward abilities, you know, I made up for the lack of obvious talent with just flat out hard work. And I've never been shy about that. And then I hooked up with a dear friend of mine, Kurt Bester. We met each other when we were freshmen in college. And Kurt's a really hardworking guy and with huge gifts. And the two of us hooked up and we collaborated for a number of years. And that was really pivotal. And we're still dear friends to this day. I still respect him immensely as a creator, composer, a fellow musician. So just lots of really fortuitous things happened at pivotal points in my life that made it possible for me to continue my passion. And you know, I didn't set out to do anything other than just continue to work and continue to try and put bread on my family table. And it's worked out, and I'm very, very grateful for that blessing.
So this is kind of their call. I'm assuming that they're somewhere east, and they feel the call to go west.
Do you think in stories?
Yeah, like that? Almost always.
Really? Is that unique to you, or is that...
I don't know. I mean, I think some people just do it as a stream of consciousness, but I like creating something in mind.
I have done very little composing for myself because of the demands of composing for other people and pursuing that as a profession. And I'm sad about that in some ways. And honestly, I don't know the answer to your question. There are a few pieces of mine that are very personal. One in particular, I grew up, as I was saying before, in this little town in New Mexico, but close to it. My father was a contractor, and he built cabins at this amazing place in the summers, and so the four sons would go up, and you know, I always say he was we were his indentured servants. And but it was just a beautiful place to be, and I really looked forward to the summers because I knew we were going to spend our time there, and that I was going to be with people that I loved. And anyway, in this location, there's a really special place that's almost sacred to our family. And on one side of this dirt road are two beautiful reflecting lakes that reflect a mountain called Middle Mountain. And on the other side is a sheer cliff. And on the side of this sheer cliff, there's a pipe that somebody ingeniously fitted in there somehow between the rock. And there's this fresh spring water that comes out of this pipe. And it's the tastiest, freshest, coolest water on the planet to this day. I would stack it up with any of the bottled waters you can get now. In fact, if you could bottle that stuff, you know, and convince people of it, it could be amazing. But anyway, we would stop there at the end of every work day and fill up canteens and, you know, wash off and take a big swig of this water. And later on my mission in Italy, when I couldn't drink water in some of the cities, I would just think back to that place. Just, what I would do for just one little swig of this amazing stuff. But anyway, this shady spot, this beautiful location became kind of hallowed ground for our family. So I wrote a piece of music about it. And to this day, it's kind of a favorite of our family, so there can never be a family gathering without me playing it. And it's one that means something to me personally, and that's nice. I've even played it in church because some people feel that it has a sacred quality about it, and it probably does because to me that place is hallowed. I don't have very many instances of others that I have done. There are lots of things I've done on assignment that I'm proud of and that mean something special because of what I went through to do it. One example, I did a project for Church Audiovisual a number of years ago, and it was as part of the seminary videos. There was a film depicting the scene in 3rd Nephi where Christ comes and speaks to the little children. And I've always thought of that as the most sacred part of any scripture anywhere, because things were said that can't be written down, and words were being spoken from the mouths of babes that were profound, and Christ was speaking to his Father in a way that I can only imagine. And so when you think about that moment, how else could you express what people were feeling except through music, which to me is one of the things that slipped through the veil. I think it's a divine way of communicating. So I've always thought about that moment as something I would... There's something I would like to do as a personal project. But anyway, I was assigned to write music to accompany this particular scene. It was a recreation of that scene. And as is typical of multimedia projects, the producers of the film had put temporary music in it. In this particular case, it was Mozart, and it was a piece called Ave Verum Corpus. Beautiful choral piece, maybe one of Mozart's top five, at least one of my top five favorites of his. So you have one of the greatest composers of all time and one of his greatest works, and that's my model. And me, with my puny skills, I'm attempting to do something that's going to have the same power and feeling that this does. So I set out to prepare myself in every way that I could think of to try and write music for this, And I had a fairly short amount of time to do it in. Usually these things, you'll be given 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So I started prepping and doing spiritual preparation as well as musical preparation and doing intellectual preparation. The Ave Verum Corpus text is Latin. I even thought about incorporating Latin into whatever it was that I was doing because there was a certain quality about it that doesn't feel Catholic like some do. Sure. There's something about it where it just feels transcendent, feels broader than that. So anyway, I wrote this piece and I felt strongly about it, and the producers came down to hear a sample of it. And, you know, nowadays we can do mock-ups, snapshots of our ideas, and it sounds pretty close to an orchestra. So they listened to it, and at the end of this, it was pretty quick. You know, the verdict was in, this isn't working. And that was crushing to me because I'd put a lot into it. To their credit, they said, you know, work some more, go to work again. So I went back, wrote an entirely new piece. This time I did do its Latin text, and I had my genius brother draw it up. And so I wrote this entirely new piece, and maybe a week later they came back down and listened to that. They didn't like that either. And they still didn't fire me. So they gave me one more shot, and I went back, and there was something about the first piece that I just felt like there was something special to it. So I went back to that, and I dressed it up and worked on it more and fleshed it out more and did some refinements to it, and I brought them back down and played that again, and they said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that's the first piece, but I fixed it as much as I can." So anyway, they ended up accepting that, and that's a special piece of music to me still. It holds up. And even though it's not the definitive piece that will ever be written on that particular subject, and it's not mine, I don't think. I hope not, because I really want to take another stab at it. But it reminds me of what it took to get to it. And it reminds me that at that particular moment in time, I was at a place where I felt receptive to spiritual things. And so it brings back all those really powerful feelings. And I think people have told me that it does that to them too, that they do feel the moment. And that's the idea, is to have people feel in a deeper way, in a more profound way, what they might already be exposed to. And that's always my ultimate goal with any kind of scoring that I do.
Same thing, my samples died.
This is a really interesting question, because I think most people think of creativity on demand as, maybe that's an oxymoron, it's a contradictory term. But you learn how to do it, you learn techniques that can get you past blocks. One thing that I read that was really fascinating to me, it's really helped me. There's a book on creativity, I don't remember who the author was, but there was an entire chapter devoted to creating over time, the willingness to trash your work if it's not working. And even if you have 2 or 3 weeks into something and it's not working, that you should be enthusiastic about trashing, throwing it away, because it's not going to make anything better. It's going to be counterproductive. And if you can think of that action of throwing away bad work as a productive activity, well, then, you know, even though you have emotional investment, you have time investment, you have all this stuff in it, it's better when you just toss it and move on. And that's really helped me when I learned to, I developed the willingness to throw away bad work. That's pretty liberating from a creative standpoint. So often, you know, my process when I get a new project, I have to clean up my environment. Everything has to be spotless when I start. I don't know why. It's just some kind of a tick. And then I will get out some CDs of things that are amazing, that are inspiring for me. And it doesn't even have to have any relation whatsoever to the particular project at hand. Just something that is a really fine piece of work that I aspire to. And that gets me into a frame of mind of wanting something to be excellent. And then I will listen to a diversity of things so that hopefully my work won't be derivative in any way. And then I try to, in the case of soundtracks, the most exciting part of that particular job is distilling the film to its essence and trying to decide, what's this about? What's trying to be communicated? Why do we care about this particular film? What's the point of it? And when you can distill it philosophically into a musical statement, that's pretty exciting, especially if you do it well. And if you can feel what you want to feel after you've created that, well, that's the fun part. And the conceptual part is fantastic. And then after you get that idea, your big idea, then the, you know, the nitty-gritty detail starts to happen, and then it starts to get unfun. And then it's unfun for a long time. And then it's not any fun again until it's done. And then the recording sessions are amazing. Because then all the hard work is over. You know, you lift up that baton and you have, and those musicians play the downbeat, and it's just thrilling. And there's just nothing like 90 people all doing something at once and synergistically, you know, putting their particular art with everyone else's and blending it and executing something that you've spent 6 weeks creating. You know, there's not a bigger thrill than that. And so all the stuff in between, I'll tolerate to get the conceptual high at the beginning and the finished product at the end. So that's what makes it worth it.
Pretty soon they're going to end up in these amazing mountains, you know, this huge continental divide, approaching the top of the continental divide.
I think Mormons, well, first of all, we don't have any corner on the market in terms of, obviously, you know, the world has produced a bunch of really amazing creators. But Mormons have the capacity, if they do it, to understand their creator to a greater degree than anybody else. And, you know, anybody that has limited understanding, more limited than we do. We have a much better sense of our creator. Just knowing that our creator is a person is a big deal. And that our creator would go through a similar process that we do. Maybe that's one of the reasons why the need to create, as Helder Uchtdorf was stating, is such an innate thing for all of us, is that we have part of that in us. You know, we have part of our creator in us. But I think knowing the creator, or having the capacity to know our creator in a more complete way, I think that's pretty key. And I realize that when I'm doing my job, that I'm communing with the divine every single day. If I'm in the right frame of mind, that's what I should be doing. And since I'm tapping into something that kind of comes out of vapor, I think that must be the case. And I can tell when I'm spiritually sharp and when I'm not. It does make a difference
in your music.
I think so. I think that I can always tell. Well, I can tell when it's craft and when it's art. There's a big difference, and I think the difference is there's a spark of the divine in things that are artistic. And craft, you're just, you know, you're showing what you've learned, but not necessarily what's inspiring or motivating.
This turned out really cool. You've heard it, right?
The spirit of the Lord is not in the entertainment business, but his spirit is in the arts. And so if you can make whatever it is that you do in the entertainment business aspire to art, there's a chance that the spirit of God might be in it. So I've always tried to take whatever assignment I have and try to find what there is in it that can aspire to art. And it can't always, you know, sometimes it's just worldwide wrestling. I don't think there's any chance of that aspiring to art. But in those times when I've had assignments that have that chance, I've tried to take full advantage of it. And, you know, if you don't try it, it won't happen. It doesn't always happen, but there are those times when it feels like art to me. And I can feel the spirit in it. When I was in college, I had an assignment to do a project some kind of a research project on a composer. So I wanted to find somebody that I would want to emulate. And after kind of digging up some stuff on, and these were classical composers, so, you know, they're people that we kind of associate with greatness, but we don't always associate with their particular character because we don't know them. But I went through and I just thought, gosh, how come most of these people that I'm reading about are so debauched in their personal life? You know, what is it about creating? What is it that causes people to, you know, to have this amazing creative gift and at the same time be such a mess in their personal life? And I remember in particular, I asked about Mozart. And I think I was talking to Newell Daly. I said, Newell, how can this amazing music come out of this guy who was, you know, he was just kind of a mess, and he was irreverent, and he, in many cases, he was vulgar, and you know, those qualities don't seem to add up to what, you know, came out in his creative works. And Newell says, well, Mozart's, you know, that gift wasn't for him, it was for us. And I think that's really true. There are many of those people who have, they're emotionally, spiritually bankrupt. But they've been given a gift, and it's not necessarily for them personally. It certainly isn't if they don't mind their P's and Q's. You know, what does it benefit them really if it causes, you know, moral decay? And they lose their gift many times. The creator and the creation, what is that relationship? Can somebody who is morally bankrupt, can they do something? Yes, I think they can. But it's not because of them. It's because of God speaking through them. And maybe they were born into this world with specialized skills for whatever reason. They can still tap into those. So, once again, I don't think... I mean, Mormon artists in general, it would certainly be more famous, wouldn't they, if they had a corner on the market in that way. We have amazing artists in the Mormon culture. But we're still gaining reputation. We're still out there working away, trying to establish what President Kimball saw many years ago in 1976 as a gospel vision of the arts. We're still trying to become that light on the hill. And I think there have been many times where the light's burning pretty bright up there. I'm thinking of our visual artists right now. The works of people like Gary Smith, James Christensen, Chris Young, you know, they're amazing, and it's absolutely as good as it gets. And so that's just a matter of calling attention to the great work. It's the great work's there, and we haven't done a good enough job of calling attention to it, maybe. And I think that there are many of our people are there. We have an amazing bunch of musicians, particularly in our singer-songwriter world, or those who are playing in bands, these little 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. It's as good as it gets. I see it all the time, and then it's just a matter of calling attention to it. You know, how do we get the word out? But the light on the hill is there, not everybody's seeing it. It's obscured by something. Maybe it's by us. When I was in the group Synthesis, we went down to the Orange Coast Jazz Festival. This was at a time it was not far after the hippie era had ended. And, you know, here's a bunch of missionary haircut, square BYU jazz players. You know, that talk about contradictory term. So think people were just laughing at us when they saw us. And then we played. And we ended up winning that jazz festival. At the end of that, Newell Daly said to us, when you combine excellence with the Spirit of God, amazing things happen. And that's what has to happen, I think, in our artistic world, in our creative world, that we have to combine excellence with the Spirit of God. We have to combine what we know about our Creator that's unique, because I do think it's a more complete picture. If we can combine that with our commitment to excellence, then really powerful things can happen that can change lives, and that can move people in spiritual ways to change their lives. That's, you know, that's the best we can hope for.